You are listening to Within Tolerance, a podcast for machinists by a machinist. I'm your host, Dylan Jackson of Protea Machining. And this week, I am very happy to re-welcome Zach Smith. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Dylan. How's it going?
It is going great. So for anybody who hasn't listened to your last episode, which for everybody who hasn't, it is 172. Definitely go back and check that out. But who are you and what do you do?
So I own a company called Our Precision. We manufacture really tiny parts here for the aerospace, medical, tech, and watchmaking industries. So we specialize in micro milling, and I'm starting to go into Swiss turning. So making lots of tiny screws, lots of tiny bridges, wheels, and various small parts.
Awesome. Well, yeah. So let's catch up. I mean, it's been over a year since the last time you were on. I think last time you were on, a fair bit of your business was still R&R for watches as well. And from what I understand, that's kind of not really a part of your business anymore. And you've acquired machinery and kind of changed your business. So let's get into it. You know, what is going on and what's changed in the last year?
Quite a bit. So last year, still working on watch repair. I had a watchmaker that was working with me, and I completely phased out of that part of the business. It just didn't make sense with parts availability not being available, you know, unavailability. And right. So just made sense to scale into more of manufacturing components for some watch brands and other industries. Just because it's hard to find watchmakers. There's really not any schools teaching micro mechanics in the US now, where basically the skills to work on making small things. Now it's just, they're just training watchmakers how to replace parts and movements. So it's kind of difficult to find employees here in Ohio for watchmaking and also the part situation. So it made sense to transition into making other micro components.
To force all repairs through authorized distributors then?
Yep.
Because I've talked to Josh and heard his story of, struggling to get parts, and it's like, oh, well, you know, I don't understand that at all, but I understand the roadblocks that they put up. They're like, oh, you're in another country and blah, blah, blah. And but you were in the US and certified and all this stuff. And so it seems crazy to me that you would not be able to get parts. I mean, I guess you're not in Switzerland, but besides that, what other roadblocks can they put up?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the hardest accounts to get is Rolex. They want you to have a authorized, an AD authorized dealer. Mayors has the Rolex boutique right there in their store, and it looked like a different store. And Rolex wants that, and then they want a Rolex certified watchmaker to work within that store, and then they will give you parts. So if you don't have that AD, you know, you're not selling brand new Rolexes, you cannot have a Rolex parts account. So that's at least, yeah, that's what I'm familiar with anyways, or how it was explained to me.
I don't blame you then for distancing yourself from that. That sounds incredibly hard as a small business to run. I mean, it's not like you have I can only assume is hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars to start up a AD. That's crazy.
And at any given point, they can yank the account from underneath you and they don't tell you why. Jeez. So it made a lot more sense in every way to just go into manufacturing. And, you know, for anyone that's aspiring to go into manufacturing that's in the watchmaking industry, it doesn't have to be micro milling or Swiss turning, or there's so many different avenues that you can go into where you can utilize some of those skills that you already have and apply them to another parallel industry.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I've had a slew of watchmakers on the show now, and I always learn something because it is such an interesting approach or sideline approach into manufacturing. And you guys do such out there stuff, things that I look at and I'm like, is that a part or a chip? You know, I often tease you on Instagram, you'll post stuff and I'm like, yeah, okay, well, where are the parts? I see your chips now. Thanks. So yeah, it's always, I always learn so much from you guys. I definitely appreciate it.
Likewise, people doing the big things always blows my mind.
So
the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, definitely. So I think last time we spoke, you only had one Kern, or did you have two at that point?
I believe it was two.
Okay. Two. So yeah, let's get into all the machinery that you've acquired since kind of repositioning your business.
Sure. So now I'm starting to, since it's just me heavily focused on jobs that are going to be able to be automated. So doing that, I decided to buy a Kern Evo. It's the next step up from the other two machines that I have before getting to a Micro Vario. And it's robot ready. So bought a robot, a UR robot, which isn't traditionally paired with this machine. Typically comes with either a 3R or an Aroa palette changer. So it's going to be interesting interfacing this robot with it. It's not really recommended.
I don't know anybody better than you to figure it out.
There's still time. We'll see. I'm not overly confident about it.
Well, that's awesome. So what are the specs on the machine that you purchased?
So that's a good question, actually. The travel is a little greater. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but X, Y, Z travels are all greater. It's more of a five-axis machine. So the last Kern that I got, I made it into a five-axis machine. It wasn't intended to be. And there's things that, you know, an early Heidenhain control, even though Heidenhain, as you all know at this point with your recent purchase.
Yeah.
That it's
starting to learn. I would definitely not say I know it, but I'm starting to learn.
But the fluidity of Heidenhain with five-axis, it's designed for five-axis, and they were really just starting to figure things out on the 426 control, which was like in the 1999, in that era. And so back to what I was saying, the travels of the axes, they're limited. So I actually had to unbolt the Z axis and move it and all that kind of crazy stuff. And it was a lot to get that going. And now basically with this machine, just put the 5-axis turntable on it, plug it in, it's ready to go. Your parts are going to be repeatable. Stop messing with the machine. Focus on the parts. So that was really the goal. It has a robot door. So that was a plus. The resolution of the machine is greater. So probably I would say two orders of magnitude more precise than the last machine. So
wow,
it's going to be, maybe it's an order of magnitude, I would say, actually. Order of magnitude.
Even then, that's significant.
Yeah. So it's just going to, like the other machine, the HSPC, it's a great machine, nothing wrong with it. Great for watch parts, but going into other industries, when you're working with a belt driven axis, it's probably not ideal. So the Evo's direct driven, there's this rapids and speeds are twice as fast. The axes are wider, so it's beefier for cutting titanium or steel. So it was every reason to get it and upgrade. From the last one, it was time.
Awesome. Yeah, so this is 530. And then I think you had told me that it has significantly more tools too, right?
Yeah. So 95 tools, I believe. That's 530. Cool. Yeah.
That's super cool. Well, I don't want to sideline this before we get off machines, but then you've also acquired a Swiss lathe.
Yeah. So that's actually a really interesting story. A really great story. All of you are probably familiar with Dan Rudolph, and Dan is a really special dude. We've chatted back and forth on Instagram, and he was telling me about some issues with this Swiss that I acquired from him with the glass scale. And one day I got a message from him that he was just done with the machine. And he says, "Hey, do you want this R04? And I said, "Yeah, sure, absolutely. Just tell me how much you want for it and I'll come pick it up." And he just kept avoiding telling me the price. And I was like, does he want a lot of money for it? Or is like, what's the thing? And then finally, he's just like, let me just ask my dad. He goes, just come pick it up. It's yours. So he just gave it to me for free. And that's, I don't know. I don't have any words. Just
that's amazing.
Incredibly grateful. Incredibly grateful.
So cool. So
the coolest.
And it kind of fits your whole business and who you are. Cause like, you're so good at fixing older machinery. Like it makes sense that it would find a home with you.
Yeah. Josh, I think it's Josh Hacko or my friend, Darren Tiffany. They joke around. They call my shop the junkyard of machines because, and they're not wrong. At least it's not the place where they come to die.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That you've given them all a new life. And I think that that's so awesome. And like I think you take on challenges that a lot of us wouldn't do. And maybe it's because of your background, but like for me, I see a broken Fanuc based machine. I'm like, oh, I can fix this. I've done this a million times. I see a broken or like a Heidenheim based control or something that needs work. And I'm like, all right, well, that's destined for the scrapyard. And you're like, no, let's do this. Like, I can figure this out. Oh, I want to add a five axis. Sure. I want to add probing. Sure. You know, you just like figure it out, man. So it's a super commendable and really cool to see.
Thanks.
So there's but speaking of fixing things, I want to get into, you also were or are still working for Kern off and on.
Yeah. So a lot of people don't know that. I am one of, I don't know if I'm the only, maybe there's two EvoTechs here in the US, but I'm the primary EvoTech, HSPC, MMT, MMP tech. And it's unfortunately coming to an end in May. I did it the entire year last year, simultaneously running my business as I pivoted it. So it worked out in the beginning. Towards the end of the year, it was a little stressful. Now it's beyond stressful. And it's bittersweet because it's been one of the, it's been the biggest life-changing experience that I've ever had. Just being able to go to meet so many customers and to travel to so many cool places, meet all kinds of cool people in the Kern factory that I wouldn't otherwise have been able to speak with, and be able to work with the team here in the US. The whole Kern, the KPI, Kern Precision team in the US is amazing. They're like, I don't know. When you see Grimsmo's video back on YouTube, when he and Saunders did the video of the factory, and they say, you know, it's like a family. It really is. And I can say that is the truth. So it's leaving them, you know, I'm still going to be part of the family there, and if they ever need anything, I'm always there for them. But it's definitely bittersweet.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. But I'm also sure that the travel is just a killer, especially when you're dealing in sectors where, you know, a rush is kind of a standard order. So,
oh yeah,
it's kind of hard to be like, oh no, I need to push your 3-day turnaround off a week and a half because I'm going to be out fixing somebody else's machine. You know, I can't imagine that that's a tenable position to be in for any amount of time.
It's not easy. Next week, I'm going to be out of the country for them. And I have probably 8 jobs going on right now in the shop that just, if it's not one job, I'm just bouncing off to the other one because, yeah, just trying to stay on top of the deadlines.
Oh boy. Well, so how did you end up getting this job? Was it through just the fact, you know, sheer willpower of like fixing your own machines and becoming the expert? Or did you have any training, or, you know, how did this all work?
That's it. Yeah. So I fixed the first machine. The first machine was in a complete state of disarray. The second machine just had some demons that needed to be resolved. And after that machine was in good order, Tony, he's the CEO of Kern US, he called me and he said, hey, do you want a job to work for us? And I was like, it's kind of hard to leave. Once, for anyone that's self-employed, it's hard to go back to that. And especially with the amount of investment that I've put into the business, it just didn't make sense. So I told him respectfully, I can't. It's not that I don't want to, it's just I can't. And some time went by, and then he called me again and said, hey, do you want to work for us as a contractor? But you represent us, you show up on the job, wearing the uniform. So sure, no problem. So didn't have any training. They offered training if I was going to go take a W-2 job with them, because it's a significant investment, which makes total sense. And I guess I was learning things fast enough to where it didn't really justify for them to make the expenditure.
You clearly know your stuff. Like, for them to put that trust in you, regardless training or not, like that, and you know, to wear their, you know, logo and all of that stuff, like, clearly you know your stuff. Like, that's pretty amazing.
Thank you. I love the brand. It's it's one of the biggest parts of my business, and I want to make sure that it's represented properly. So for both me and for them.
Definitely. So kind of alongside this, Phil reached out and said I should pick your brain about kinematic calibrations and all of that stuff and probing, because you wrote a lot of this stuff for your machines. And you mentioned, you know, raising the Z on one of your machines. You have gotten kind of down and dirty with Heidenhain and figuring out all that stuff. So, you know, talk to us about figuring out that.
So as far as probing, raising the Z, that was a nightmare, because the Z axis, well, the whole reason that I had to do that was this, after adding probing and adding the fifth axis, because of how high up the turntable sits where your part would sit onto it, the work surface was too high for the probe to be able to touch it because the probe is so long. So I probably could have run it if I didn't use a probe, but when you have a complicated part, it's nice to have probing. So raise the Z axis. And with that being done, the stock kinematic programs don't work. So you need to go through this entire program that is filled with variables and if then statements. And I had to tailor make it to the machine itself. I almost crashed the machine a few times doing that. So that was pretty scary. But I basically just took a Evo, because this is an HSPC. So the HSPC, everything is different here. The nomenclature for five axis, the buttons on the control, it's A and B. It's not even B and C, which is what it's supposed to be. So,
oh wow.
You know, it was really early on to where they didn't even have that stuff figured out. So the actual kinematic table, which is where all those values from the program that I wrote or modified get inputted into, it's not easy to understand, because in the control in the back end for five axis, there cannot be any negative values in the angles for the turntable. So it starts at, I think, 120, and 120 is like minus 20 or something like that. Or minus.
Weird.
Yeah, super strange. So as you go down, that's the B axis moving downward. And so it took some time to just kind of wrap my head around all that stuff first. And then once I understood it, modify this program that was written for the Evo, and then getting those values to input into the back end, it was a total nightmare. I think it took me at least 2 months to get that thing squared away.
That's crazy. So what kind of resources did you use to learn this stuff or figure it out as you went?
Nothing.
Just kind of reading through the program? And did you have like the Heidenhain manuals and you were just going through that, or?
The manuals, the service manual has some, it touches, if anyone looks up the 426 manual and looks at the five axis kinematic, there's the kineset table and there's the, there's an A and a B correction, which is like the B axis and the C axis correction table. It touches on it, but it doesn't give you any explanation of what the rest of the table really, like how to set it up. It's really for a machine tool builder to do. So, and it was, I don't even have a wiring diagram for the machine. So that was like, it didn't have power supplies. I had to find free PWM inputs into the control. To get both the encoder for the, the tracking of the axes and then the motor encoders and the digital drive motors, get that, the tuning for the motors. That was a whole nother nightmare. Real challenge. And then, man, the day when I cut my test part and I stuck it on the measuring inspection system, and I got, I think it was between cutting a part at zero, B0, so top down, and then rotating the part 90 degrees and cutting like eight slots around 360 degrees. It was like 5 microns of accuracy from concentricity from the flats to the center hole that I interpolated through the top. And I was like, that was the most exciting day I ever had.
That's wild. So how long did that whole process take end to end, do you think?
It was 2 months.
And then was the probing on top of that as well?
Probing I set up in 2 days.
Wow. Okay.
Was that
fairly well documented in the
Probing for the artifact?
Yeah, well, just probing in general, because did the machine come with a probe?
No, it didn't. So probing in general was 2 days. I had already done it on the first machine, which I don't know if there's any MMTs that have a probe. That might be one of the few.
So how do you even go about figuring out like the MMT then? Like, did you ask Kern and say, is this even possible? Or did you just say, I want probing and I'm just going to do it no matter what?
I asked them and they told me I needed to buy this microscope. Like it's got an HSK.
Yeah, the spindle mounted like microscope.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And they weren't wrong for it, honestly, because there's so many things you run into. And from a support aspect, if I was them, I wouldn't offer it, even if I knew. So they may have known, but I don't, it wasn't recommended. So
I guess what I'm getting at is like, if they told you no, how did it happen? You just bought the stuff and you're like, I'll make it work. Damn it.
Yeah. Yeah. Just took a gamble, bought a Renishaw OMP 400 probe and the OMI 2, I think it was the receiver. And I think either X12 or X13 on the back of the Heidenheim unit is for probing. One of them is for the laser and the other one's for the probe. I forget which is which. I think it's X13. And you just need to open the manual. There's a pinout for it. And you put a transistor between, I think it's the start. At least, yeah. So like the start for the probe to start. And then there's some configuration to do in the control. And that's not terrible. You just go into the machine parameters. There's some things you can edit. The real challenge was on my HSPC, because that's when I really got into probing. And what I wanted was the probe to orient. It touches, like if it's a circle, you want it to touch 4 points and the same part of the probe to touch all those points. So it wasn't rotating the spindle, and you would enable the feature, you would go into probe, and then the thing would just stop, and you'd have to e-stop the machine to get it to like get out of the probing cycle. So like, why isn't this working? And eventually I figured out that the probe interface and the probe, they expect the signal back faster than the control can process it.
Oh, wow.
So I was like, okay, so it just needs to be slowed down. So the logical thing for me was to took something like a development board that's Arduino. It's like an Arduino platform. And basically I just cut the wire or added another. So you have to drop the voltage because it's 24 volts from the probe into Arduino, which is 5 volts, and drop the voltage. And then there's an input. So it's waiting for the probe to error out. And as soon as it recognizes that the probe errors out, there's an output coming out of the Arduino into the trigger or into the start. That's what it is, into the start pin. And it just, for a millisecond, it flashes and it turns the probe on and off. And the probe cycle resumes before the machine can figure out what's going on. So that's how I got around it. And it works great. Still works. Super accurate.
Okay, so I want to touch on one thing you just said there. You just said the logical thing to do would to be put this Arduino in between the machine and the probe. No, this is not, that's not logical for anybody but you. That's amazing that you figured that out. I think most people at that point would have just said, guess probing's not going to work on this machine.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, man. And then so on the newest one, it's got the 5-axis table already. Does it already have probing set up?
Yeah, it came with the probe. It was just like amazing.
And so that one, you can run the normal kinematic calibration and all that stuff. You don't have to worry about it. You're not having to write your own software for it.
I don't have to do anything.
Okay.
It's the best thing ever.
That's amazing. Well, I guess you enjoy it and you appreciate it that much more because you have struggled through all of these, you know, setups that you've done.
I don't know if this, is this stream on video online?
No.
It doesn't. Well, in the background is my first machine. And if anyone comes to my shop and looks at it, it's there to laugh at because there's some really silly things that I had to do to make some small watch gears and stuff. So it's come a long way.
What is your first machine? It looks like a Sherline or something like that, or an X2.
Close enough. It's an Emco F1.
Okay.
With ball screws where I added preload to all of them and changed the entire table out. So there's like no wear in it. It's brand new. And there was a NSK spindle mounted to the side of the headstock or the head. So I could, it's like max 3000 RPM in the main spindle, 20,000 RPM on the spindle on the side.
That's awesome.
It's got steppers.
It looks fairly similar to a mill that my old boss almost gave me. It was a TOS something. And it was like, it was kind of like a, I don't know, Eastern European copy of a copy. It had steppers, I think. It was like this. It kind of looked like an education unit, like the way that it was packaged. Like it had its own stand. It had its own stuff. But it was open like that. And I kind of think that my lucky stars that like I didn't end up taking that home, because it would have been such a nightmare. Like at the time, I knew nothing about machining, let alone, you know, replacing these ancient steppers with like something that would actually work, and figuring this all out. And like, oh my goodness, I'm just so glad I never went down that rabbit hole, because I'd probably still be lugging it from house to house with me right now, completely dead.
Blue pill, red pill, right? I think,
yeah,
this is an education machine. That's why I'm laughing. Yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah. Let's see. Well, we got some questions. From the Patreon, Zap asked, why do you aim to haunt our nightmares by using Notepad? So I complained at you a bunch. We're in a group chat together. We've all given you shit about Notepad over VS Code. So what's with the Notepad, man?
It's superior. What do you mean, what's with the Notepad? I know Dan will back me up on this.
I am sure. I'm not sure, but I can see him clipping this part and just reaffirming that you are correct. I disagree, but yeah, every time I see it, I'm just like, but why?
I know posting this on Instagram is going to trigger people every time, so I get a kick out of it. And I think really I'm super ADHD. So if there's a bunch of colors on the screen, my mind's not with it.
Oh, interesting. Okay. That's totally fair. Totally fair. Let's see. Possum Solutions. How much is he into the Swiss machine? Is an old use Swiss recommended? And what quantity is the minimum that makes sense to do on a Swiss?
Those are all really, really good questions. So everyone knows what I'm into it for, at least for the base machine. Tooling itself gets really pricey. I bought a lot of thread rolling dies and learned the hard way. You definitely want to make sure if you're doing thread rolling that you have indexing on the sub spindle. I didn't. No complaints, but I had to find a way on how to do it, and I got it to work. But it's kind of like the probing situation on the Kern. The thread rolling stuff, the cutting tools, I don't know, maybe like $3,000 in, or two.
What did it take to fix the scale issue?
There's nothing wrong with it yet.
Oh, okay. Great.
But there is no replacement. Yeah, there's no replacement for it. So when it dies, the machine is basically obsolete.
No way.
Yeah.
It's just not produced anymore, or is it a citizen-specific scale or something?
It's actually, so it's a Fennec control. The scales are Heidenheim. And yeah, super crazy, right? Yeah. And it's a really obscure size. And I think it's a 50 nanometer read head on that scale. So could probably take the scale apart and clean it if it gets dirty. That's usually what happens. But if the read head dies, I'll have to either find a read head, or if the scale gets scratched, then I'm SOL. You're not going to find one.
Wow. That's wild. And then what did it take to do indexing? I had completely forgotten that you did that on your own.
Yeah. So actually, what is his Instagram? It's Scott Lee, race something, repeat, race, fix, repeat.
Yeah.
Scott Lee, he works at Burger Engineering, but he was an apps engineer for Citizen. So he gave me some guidance. It's able to index. So at whatever position it stops, you can tell it to go 180 degrees, but it's relative to whatever position it's already at. So it doesn't find home and then go to 180.
How weird.
So it's missing something. So I added a Keyence optical sensor and a reference to the spindle, and added a M code to the control. So in the PLC, basically I'm not going to get too crazy into depth. So basically you go in the PLC, you add an M code, and you're just looking for an input. And the input is when that trigger signal gets cut by the reference. And so say M62, when that's the M code for to turn on the optical sensor. As soon as you enter M62, it hangs there until the light's interrupted. Then it moves to the next line. So you do like a spindle, sub-spindle, move at 30 RPMs, dwell for 4 seconds, M62. And then as soon as it hits M62, you can do spindle S0 and it'll lock the sub. And then you can rotate, I think it's an M78 for orientation, if I'm not mistaken. And then like S120 for 120 degrees. And then you can, you know, get it. And it's pretty accurate.
Dude, that is so crazy. Oh my goodness. So actually, and I want to, before we get on to the rest of the Possum Solutions questions, why thread rolling versus cutting? Is it due to the size of the screw that you're making? Or like I have zero idea. Like I said, I make fun of you because your parts are microscopic. So how did you come across how to make these kind of threads reliably? And like, what can you share with us about making them reliably and not screwing them up?
Sure. So before I start, I got to give a huge thanks to Josh Hacko. He, for any guys that don't know him, he's NH Micro on Instagram, Nicholas Hacko Watch on Instagram. And he is a wealth of knowledge for both Kern stuff and Swiss stuff. We do some of the same, some similar work. And he gave me a lot of tips on how to do this and basically what I would want to do and wouldn't want to do. And then I took that knowledge and combined with the work that I was taking in, decided what would make the most sense. So with thread rolling versus single point threading, and this goes back to the other question that he asked about what quantities does a Swiss make sense. So I've made the mistake of taking in an order of 100 pieces, and I can assure you 100 pieces is not worthwhile. Today I made, I think it was 80 screws to dial in the program, and it's still not dialed in yet.
Oh,
and
they're
all bad, all 80 of them. So that the slot's not even in it yet. So this is just adjusting thread rolling and the dimensions, because you have to make one screw for each adjustment, measure it, and then make another adjustment. So I would say the minimum order that you'd like, or minimum quantity that you'd want to do for Swiss is probably 1,000 pieces. And that's anything under 1,000 to 1,000 pieces, I would do single point threading. The challenge with single point threading is getting an insert that has a tip radius under 0.2. So if your thread pitch is below that, you're not going to be able to cut it. So you have to custom grind your threading tool. So I do this for small quantities. And the reason why it's worth it is you don't need a collet to pick off with at the sub. You don't need thread rolling dies, which can get expensive if you're doing a whole setup. And the setup time to do thread rolling is a little longer than single point threading. So there's disadvantages to that over 1,000. I was talking to Josh about this today, actually, where we were talking about the wear of the cutoff tool. Since you're not cutting, you're not picking off, and you're turning the screw backwards, essentially, right? So the head first, you're slotting it first, then you're turning the profile, and then you're threading it, and then you part it, and then there's going to be a little pip on the end of the screw. So the pip gets greater as that cutoff tool wears. So if versus if you're going to do thread rolling, you're turning the screw the other way, threads first, you're doing the profile, you're threading it, then you're going to part it off, it transfers into the sub, you slot the head, and then the parts collector comes in and sucks it into the collection bottle. So that makes sense to do when it starts to be like 2,000 pieces and up.
Okay. Makes sense. And I would imagine that if the pip is a real pain in the ass under, you know, 100 parts or whatever, it's not that bad to kind of go in there and figure it out, you know, with a file or something, but like, you're not doing that for 1,000 pieces.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned something there too, that you posted in your stories. Let's talk about your adventures in parts catching.
Sure. So it's really like, it's the thing you think about the least. At least for me, I was so concerned about getting everything dialed in. I can't take any credit for anything that I've done here except for one method. My favorite method is the one that Dan uses, and he has this, or had this plastic piece that was like machined attached to his part catcher. And there's like a tube that goes through one end and out through the other, and it extends. The subspindle will go up to that piece of tubing and then blow air through the back of the subspindle, and it shoots the part out into a bottle or a container. And Citizen also does this with a small container. Just instead of using that plastic thing with the tubing, they'll have a small container there with a small hole on the opposite end and then a bigger hole where the part's going to go into. So same concept. So that's, none of that's my idea. And that works great if you're doing pickoff with the sub. But if you're going to do the method where you're doing single point threading, you can't use that. And my first idea was 3D printing a holder for a watch cleaning basket. So like for a parts cleaner for watches, it holds the basket, and then that 3D printed tool goes around the housing of the subspindle, and then you just command the subspindle to come in, and you have to move your cutoff tools to the opposite side of the, like, so on the Swiss, you have two gangs, and at least on the R04. So there's the $2 gang and the $1 gang. And typically you're using, yeah. So $1 is spindle one and the tool gang away from you. And then $2 is the tool gang towards you and the subspindle. And basically tool number 23 is what I was using for cutoff, which is on $2. So like the gang towards me. So you have to move it to the other side, because otherwise what's going to happen is the slotting tool that's in the live tool is going to crash into the basket. So that's one way to do it, where you can catch it with the basket where the sub comes in and the basket's like attached to the sub. And then the other way
working, because I remember when you first did it, we were talking and you were like, I was like, oh, that's such a cool idea. And you're like, yeah, it didn't work at all. Cool.
Yeah, I didn't think about moving the cutoff tool to the opposite post.
Okay.
And then it made sense. I was like, okay, because there was the next method I'm going to talk didn't work for one of the screws because the screws were too big. So I had to use that method. And so the other method is I took off cutoff tool number 23 and got a tool blank, like one of those high-speed steel blanks that you can grind, and just use that as a pressure plate to press a tubing into that tool cavity there, and then cut an angle of off the tubing so that way it's parallel, or sorry, perpendicular with this with the guide bushing. So the parts, when they get cut off, they'll fall right into it. And I used a Venturi valve, and I removed the airline from the subspindle blow off, put it into the Venturi, and then screwed the Venturi valve onto a bottle. Then at the bottom of that bottle, a quick connect fitting back into the oil tank. So that way, when the blow off, you can command a blow off, but it's actually sucking the screw into this tube, and then it blows it into the bottle, and then all the excess oil that gets caught in there goes back into the tank, and there's a fine screen in the bottle.
That is so awesome.
We're great.
I love that. That is so cool. So, would you recommend an old used Swiss?
Yes, I would. Only if your business doesn't depend on it entirely.
Okay.
So if it is your business every single day, day in, day out, maybe at first you'll have to start off with a used Swiss because it's easy to get into. But going forward at this point, what I can say is I plan to buy a new one. And that makes sense for me because I'm looking to focus more on Swiss work. The Kerns are going to kind of be support tools for that. And yeah, if you're going to rely on it, just get something that works, turns on, because the worst thing ever is having to come into work and tell your customers, hey, can't meet the deadline because I got to fix the machine. So
been there, done that. Don't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Let's see. Tux Garage asked, what is your favorite machine? How do you keep track of really tiny parts, and any recommendations for how to hold tiny screws and parts? And also, how do you like your arepas?
I'll answer the arepa question first. I love arepas. I like the Venezuelan arepas with queso blanco, like the white cheese.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah. So for my favorite machine, it's the Swiss. It's definitely the Swiss. It's a fun machine.
That's awesome. I'm really glad you're enjoying it because like I could see, for me looking in, you know, from the outside in, there seems like so many parts of it that would be very frustrating for me, specifically his question about handling tiny screws. Like I know that anytime I have to work on anything with screws that tiny or even threads that tiny, we did a bunch of like M.8 thread parts last week and then some M1.2s this week, and it's just like I hate the thread gauges, I hate the feel of them, I hate all of it. Like, so I'm really glad that you're enjoying it, but
those are pretty small.
I mean, not compared to some of your parts, but like for me that's tiny. Like I bought a little Dixie thread whirler for it, and I'm like, oh great, okay, and dialing that thing in, and I'm like, the M1.21 is like about where my comfortability ends. Like the M.8 stuff is when I can't see the tooth on the thread mill, and I'm like, cool, well it's either there, it's not, you know, it's Schrodinger's part or tool up until the coolant turns off and I can check the thread. So anyway, how do you keep track of them, and any recommendations for me as well, holding tiny screws and parts and dealing with them and keeping them organized, cleaning, all of that? Because cleaning I could see being an absolute nightmare. Like I could personally, I have almost washed parts down the sink that are like, you know, fit on my thumbnail, so I can't imagine screws the size that you're making.
Those are all really good questions. I say that because these are things I'm still working through, and this is why I like this so much, because the Swiss is a really process driven machine, and so are the Kerns in terms of achieving accuracy, but this is very process driven in terms of order of operations. And there's something really satisfying about setting up processes for me. So whether it's cleaning processes, plating processes, machining. So for cleaning, I use a variety of strainers. So I have coarse, finer, 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 and the ultrasonic. And this is just nothing fancy, Amazon ultrasonic. I have an Elma ultrasonic, and the Amazon Chinese one works better. And
oh wow,
yeah, maybe it's because the Elma's old, but it's not that old. It's like, I don't know, 5 years old. But so that first, and then I have a watch cleaning machine. So for the non-watchmakers, there's a company called Grainer Vibrograph, and the machine is the ACS 900. It's a centrifugal cleaning machine. So there's four jars in it and heating station. The first jar has ultrasonic, and you would put like an ammoniated solution in that. And then the consecutive jars, you either use naphtha based solvent or IPA 99. And I've been using IPA 99. I like the way it works and then how it dries. And then the last station is drying. So everything dries without residue, you know, your parts are clean. And at that point, then I'll demagnetize the parts. So I have a demagnetizer, and then I'll measure them. Final measurement. There's every 20 screws or 30 screws I'll measure, sometimes every 50.
Okay.
Off the machine. About
handling? Any tweezers you really like? Any
yes.
things that you practice just to not, you know, with tweezers flick a part off into the nether and never see it again?
Yep. So Virjon number 2 tweezers are what I use. Virjon is just a distributor. Some Swiss company's making it for them for sure.
Okay.
And I like them because they're anti-magnetic. Number 2s, everyone with that first goes to watches for some reason, not everyone, but quite a few people gravitate towards these like number 4, number 5 tweezers, which are like really fine tweezers. And those are so springy. And that is the greatest way to flick apart into oblivion. And the number 2s have a little more beef to them. So those are nice. And then there's also some other pliers that are called H-type tweezers. And those are almost like pliers. So they're blunt on the end. And those are great because you can't really fling it as easily. So those, I use tweezers. If you wanted to get crazy with like assembly, I know some of the factories use vacuum pens for like lifting parts, but it's not really ideal for handling screws. At least moving, okay. manipulating them for measuring. Yeah.
But yeah, for sure. I've got some Oratech Delrin tipped tweezers that we use a fair bit for parts that I don't want to scratch. Those things are fantastic.
Those are awesome.
I ended up buying some like, what is it? Engineer brand. It's like some Chinese off brand, but they make a carbon nylon tip one as well. But like we have gravitated towards the plastic tip ones for aluminum part, like tiny aluminum parts, because I've definitely scratched the hell out of parts with like a normal set of tweezers. But yeah, all of that watchmaking stuff, you know, my brief deep dive into it for like a few weeks before I jumped on the next hobby, it definitely got me some good tools at least. So
another good hack is if you want a little more rigidity, get the number H tweezers and polish them, like the insides of them, to like high polish. And that's how I handle watch bridges.
Okay.
Won't scratch them.
Interesting. So what does the polish get you?
It just doesn't like the tip, any of the sharp edges. It's not going to transfer any scratches, where if you're moving it around, there's no sharp edges.
I gotcha. Let's see. Northwest Manufacturing asks, what's your go-to end mill brand for microwork?
I would have to say NS Tool or Dixie Poly Tool. Those are probably the two. It just depends on what you're working on. For the hard stuff, I'm really, really, really keen to try 6C tooling. You've probably heard of them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. 6C is, they're just doing some amazing things. And Jens, who's the CEO and did the research and development for these tools, he is just wicked smart, really cool dude. And I can't wait to have a reason to buy the tools.
A ton of fun to hang out with.
Yeah. One of the best guys. I cannot think of a better time that I've had out. It was a good time hanging out with Jens.
Let's see. Alex Kern asked, what's the plan moving forward? How long until you need to hire someone? What are your current obstacles you're facing? And when will you buy a Kern HD?
Ooh. So hiring. I really need to hire someone now for admin work. I'm doing some pretty dumb things. Like last month, I was doing anywhere between 18 and 19 hours a day, every day. And it's not sustainable. This month, I told myself, you know, not going to do that. I got to just let it flow into the next day. And I need to find someone for admin. That'd probably be the first role that I'd be looking to fill, because I just cannot do everything. And I need someone to help me stay on top of billing, paperwork, emails, answering the phone, maybe quoting eventually. Everything else is automated except that.
Okay. That might be an easier hire around you too. I know you mentioned earlier that, you know, Ohio might not be the easiest to find a micro machinist just hanging out. So admin might be a pretty, or at least an easier hire.
For sure. Yeah, I think so. The school's right here, OSU.
Oh yeah, that'd be great then. So what are the current obstacles besides, you know, crazy hours and needing a person? Anything else?
Been a barrage of projects and climate control. That was a big one. Now, finally, my shop has climate control. It's not perfect. There's a lot of ceiling space. So that's something I'm going to dive into as I get the Evo running. Oh, I forgot to answer the HD for Alex. He asked, when am I going to get an HD? And it's when the work permits. I was flirting with the idea of getting a Vario or an HD this year, and the Evo was an easier stepping stone before jumping into a machine of that caliber.
Totally. Yeah. And it'll let you get, you know, your automation fix and all that stuff. It seems like it's a really good solution for a broad spectrum of problems that you're having.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, that brings me on to shop news and new things. We've gone over a lot of new things, but anything else new or exciting in your world?
Yeah, I'm trying to take a little time off of just grinding on machining and focusing more on metrology. And I had Keyence come in yesterday with the LM unit, or LMX unit. And I have the IM series right now. Great machine. It's one of the most used tools that I use as far as for inspection. However, it's not the only tool that I can rely on. And it's something that I'm trying to figure out where I get either a CMM from Zeiss or maybe a combination of a machine from Zeiss and a vision inspection system if it's not combined. And pretty impressive unit. It was cool to have that come in, and it's significant upgrade. The LM, it's has a lot more resolution than the IM series does. So for micro parts, it's a super powerful machine, and they improved a lot of the problems that the IM series, the older IM series has, like mine, where you have to get the lighting just right for it to measure properly. They really figured it out with this machine. The only thing that wouldn't work for me is the probing. It's, I believe, has a four to five micron error, like, or not error, but repeatability in Z, and it's just not enough resolution. But that was something exciting that happened this week.
Yeah, that's super cool. So you're cross-shopping that with like O-Inspect then from Zeiss?
Yeah, O-Inspect, Duramax, and the Keyence LM, just kind of trying to figure out what the happy medium is.
Are they all similarly priced?
The O-Inspect is pretty pricey. That's the most expensive machine.
Okay.
The Duramax I would say I think it's half the amount of the O-Inspect.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize the O-Inspect was that expensive.
I want to say it's $280 or somewhere in this price range.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I could be totally off, but I think it's somewhere in that price range. The Duramax, I think, is 80 or 90,000, somewhere around there. And the LM series that was in my shop, I think was 100-ish, maybe 110 with the probe. And the LM without the probe and without the rotary attachment, I think is in the $70,000 range, which is super doable.
So then would you get something like that and then like a Heidenhain vertical scale just to check Z's with, if you were going to pair it like that?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Or
that might be a good solution then to that problem.
Or both CMM, like a Duramax and the LM, and then just combine both. Josh had some really good input on that where he's like, it's going to suck to work with two different softwares for keeping track of all the measurements. And he's not wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, seriously.
So going with one system, it's definitely appealing.
Yeah. Though knowing you, I don't see that it would be any problem for you to write, you know, some kind of script to pull all the stuff into a Excel spreadsheet or something like that.
There's only so much time in the day. Only so much time in the day.
That's totally fair. Totally fair. Awesome. Well, I guess that brings me to the last two questions then, unless there's anything else you wanted to chat about that's happened in the last year. All right.
Then
what did you research this week? Doesn't have to be machining related, though I'm sure it probably is, but what's been popping up in your browser?
So completely unmachine related. I try and step away from my extremely unhealthy work life, or I won't say work life balance because there's no balance. I was super into riding motorcycles I'm still a kid, I'm 30, but when I was younger, and now I have one dirt bike in the shop, and it was, how do I get this thing to be street legal? And in Florida, where I lived before, it was an impossibility. So I was able to actually make it happen. This week, I was able to make it street legal, and was super weird riding on the street passing police, because it's like, I felt wrong.
Because it's a Yamaha, right? What Yamaha is it? Because at first I thought it was a WR, but then those are street legal from the factory. So it must be something else. A YZ then?
Yep. It's a YZ450F.
Oh, awesome. That's killer.
Yeah, it's
cool. Yeah, it's weird to hear of troubles street legalizing anything, because like in Arizona, yes, if it has two wheels and you can throw a mirror and a turn signal on it, not even turn signals, I think you just need a mirror and a front headlight and you're probably good. So it's always weird to hear people be like, oh yeah, I can't make that street legal. And it's like, everything's street legal. What are you talking about?
This is the beautiful thing. One of the many beautiful things of Arizona and Utah.
Yeah. But no, I'm so glad that worked out then. It looks like a killer bike.
Thank you. Really stoked.
Awesome. Well, then the last question I ask every guest every week, what are the things that you're working on to be a better person, leader, employer, what have you? None of us are perfect. We're all working on stuff. What are you working on?
Spending more time with my wife and being able to get my work hours under control for when things change in life. So family, when that happens, and being able to, just dedicate time to things that matter more than work. And then for work stuff, being organized or managing my organization and, just trying to improve certain things there, keeping track of jobs, how long it takes to do things, and just improve process. So there's less waste.
Yeah, definitely. I would imagine that learning how to quote Swiss work is going to be a difficult or a different animal to approach, because, you know, it's not like the mill work where you're probably a lot more hands-on. This one, you're like front loading a ton of hands-on work, and then it's just like, oh, let it eat for 1,000 screws or whatever. So
super bizarre.
It'd be a little weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Zach, thank you so much. It was great to get to catch up.
Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun. Can't wait till the next time.
Definitely. Thanks to all the listeners and all the Patreon members who make this show possible. You guys let me send people like Zach a mic and headset so that you guys get good audio. And thank you all for listening. I will be back next week.